try it, and the photodynamic therapy. After much deliberation, but not outright dismissal, he said he couldn't prescribe the drugs. They are not regarded as standard treatments for cancer, and I do not want to prescribe these without randomized clinical trials, he had said. No matter, I had anticipated this outcome and had already booked another appointment for her around the corner with Dr. Kenyon, who I hoped might be able to prescribe some of the drugs. By now, Rachel had quite a large tumour in her mediastinum. Both Professor Stebbing and I knew the standard medical treatments on their own were never going to control her disease for long. They would only buy her a few months, not that we said so in her presence. An hour later, Dr. Kenyon ran some tests. Rachel still appeared to have good liver function, and she hadn't been wrecked by chemotherapy at this stage. All was looking good if she wanted to start photodynamic therapy, but Rachel had other ideas. She just didn't feel comfortable with alternative treatments. She wanted to stick with convention, although she did agree to the metformin, so Dr. Kenyon, with a bit of encouragement from me, wrote out a prescription for her. I met Professor Stebbing several times with Rachel, and he gave me his email address. Together we discussed treatments she eventually decided to pursue, such as stereotactic radiotherapy. And despite the huge tumour resting between her lungs, Rachel stayed alive for a further 22 months, precious time with her young family. When she died, her passing felt like a personal failure to me, despite my efforts. I wished I had managed to get her all the drugs I felt she had needed, a proper cocktail that targeted several fuel lines. Triple negative breast cancer was tricky. What fuel did TNBC use that others didn't? It was one of the hardest cancers to cure. In her honor, I would make it my mission to find out. If I could find out what it was and how to block it, perhaps it would help reverse this dreadful disease that afflicted too many young mums. A few months later, I was asked for help again for a lady who'd been diagnosed with malignant melanoma. So I met with Beth and her two sons, both in their 20s. We all sat in my kitchen and made a treatment plan together. I sketched out a spotted bother chart and showed them the rudimentary cancer-starving triangle. We investigated lots of different natural approaches that she might want to try as well as old drugs. Everyone was happy with Beth's chosen path. It was important that the decisions were made by her. She felt it would be useful if I accompanied her to see her consultant at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London, the best-known cancer hospital in the UK. From the research done by Dr. Betty Rhodes at St. Helier Hospital on melanoma patients in the 1980s, I knew dipridamole would be helpful for her. I even managed to acquire the original paper from The Lancet. But convincing oncologists to prescribe anything off-label would be particularly hard at this bastion of traditional treatments. Still, we agreed it was worth a try. We added a statin and an NSAID to her list, as I'd found good articles on both that related to melanoma. I couldn't find much evidence for metformin at the time, so stuck to just three drugs, dipridamole, a statin, and an NSAID. The following week, I met her at the hospital. She greeted me as I entered the waiting room of the Royal Marsden, rammed full of gloomy, silent patients and families. It was standing room only. Her sons could not attend that day, and Beth introduced me to her brother and sister, who had come instead. They both eyed me with suspicion. Clearly they did not approve of my presence. When we entered the consultant's room, I realized with some dismay that he was old school. He peered at us over his reading glasses as we sat down. Beth, buoyed up by her new treatment plan and feeling more in control of her disease, launched into a quick speech about how much better she felt to have cut out sugar from her diet. Unfortunately, this set the tone for the whole meeting. Diet was the last thing he wanted to discuss.
"I have already explained that changing your diet is a waste of time," he said, as if scolding a disobedient child. "It has never been shown to help cancer patients, and all you are doing is depriving yourself at a critical stage when you should be relaxing and eating what you like best," he added.
So she might as well be gorging on chocolates, because she was going to die anyway. No wonder patients call it the Royal Mars Bar. "I wondered what you thought about her trying some photodynamic therapy," I asked, regretting the words as they fell out of my mouth. I could see his calm demeanor changing from one of tolerance to one of irritation. He looked me straight in the eye with an icy glare.
"There is no evidence that will help either," he answered curtly. "She will just be wasting her money."
If this was a difficult subject to tackle, then broaching the subject of off-label drugs was going to be really hard. For Beth's sake, I had to try and get her something. Sticking to the standard of care alone would fail. "Okay, we'll park that idea," I said, just to humour him. "I've also been looking at some off-label drugs that might help," I added nervously. "This is an article in The Lancet showing that dipridamole, an antiplatelet drug, might help stop metastases." "It stopped progression in several patients with stage 4 disease." I handed over the article. He took the piece of paper from me, said nothing and stared at it. I carried on. "Dipridamole also has antiviral properties, and the article suggests there might be a viral component to melanoma."
"This is not evidence. This isn't a randomized clinical trial. It is a study on a few patients in 1985. He made a snorting sound, and the article was thrust back at me.
Beth stole a look at me, winked, and rolled her eyes to say, "Exactly the reaction we expected." "I know it's old, but what if it's been overlooked?" I added, cross that not being new did not mean it wouldn't work. It was like saying the Beatles were rubbish because they split up in 1970. "How about looking at a statin?" I asked, bringing out the next article and aware I was rapidly losing ground.
"And what date is that research?" he asked.
2005, published in Melanoma Research," I said.
"This is 2013. If these were in any way useful, wouldn't we already be using them?"
"So you don't think they might be of some help? Do you want to read the article?" I said in a small voice. "Obviously not." The oncologist turned to Beth.
"I want a word with you, alone."
Crikey, that hadn't gone well. I knew I was going to meet with some resistance, but it had been far worse than Beth or I had expected. He stood up, opened the door, and beckoned for her brother, sister, and me to leave the room. We filed out, and once again he threw me a huge scowl. I turned to see that Beth was okay, and he slammed the door shut in my face. I could hear him talking in heated tones to Beth. I felt bad. I'd been trying to help, and it wasn't fair that she'd been caught in the crossfire between us. I was also upset he had been so dismissive without even examining all the evidence. Where was patient choice? But what happened to me next was truly shocking. As soon as I was in the corridor, her brother and sister turned on me. Dave towered over me and pinned me against the wall. They both began yelling in my face, Dave jabbing me in the chest with his finger.
"Who the hell do you think you are? Are you a doctor? How dare you make suggestions to the oncologist? You have no right interfering with her treatment."
I stood there trying to breathe calmly. I'm just trying to help her," I stammered. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. I was desperate to escape. There was little point entering into a discussion with them. They were in no mood to listen. I wriggled my way out of their grip and quickly headed for the door.
"Don't you dare contact her again," shouted her sister at my back as I sped to the exit.
Cancer is a confusing and frightening experience for the whole family, and I knew they were only acting in what they thought were her best interests. As much as I told myself that they were only being overly protective, I was very shaken by this physical and verbal abuse. Once safely outside the hospital, I sent Beth a text with an excuse about having to go home urgently. She probably guessed they had been rude to me, but I never told her what they'd done. Beth and her sons would have been mortified if they'd ever found out. She had enough on her plate. Helping a desperate patient was one thing, but dealing with protective, angry relatives was quite another. I vowed to never accompany anyone on a visit ever again. It was not good for my own health. But how would patients ever get hold of these drugs? It seemed an impossible task. Oncologists were bound by rigid protocols. God forbid they should prescribe anything as innovative as low-dose aspirin to help a dying patient. Later, I sent her off to see Dr. Calibou, but she never asked for dipridamole or any of the other drugs. I believe her oncologist at the Royal Marsden put her off. Why had he been so antagonistic and angry? And why shouldn't she try and save herself by any means possible? Had the oncologist felt threatened by me questioning his authority? This was not patient-centered care. To my dismay, I learned that she died 6 months later. I felt I had failed again. I couldn't help but wonder how she would have fared if only she'd taken a drug cocktail. When would the oncology profession wake up? Could they not see how rigid and inflexible they were? Closed to every suggestion. It seemed for no good reason at all. How had this arrogance got so bad? What on earth had gone wrong with the profession to make them behave like trained killers, refusing to allow patients to save themselves?
My way or the highway, I decide how you're going to die.
Oncology was so messed up and the losers were the patients.
Once you're diagnosed with stage four, you're given few options but to go on a treadmill of approved drugs, none of which have ever cured anyone with advanced disease. New drugs and trials are so overhyped in the press that people have too much faith in them. The pharmaceutical industry have hoodwinked the medics, and especially the vulnerable patient, into believing modern medicine and their patented drugs hold all the answers. It is only natural to believe the latest drug is going to be better than the last. But if you examine the statistics, this, sadly, is not the case. The NHS budget is so tight, it relies on most patients with stage 4 dying with the first treatment option, invariably high-dose chemotherapy. The cheapest, but least effective treatment. A dead patient is a massive saving. It is far cheaper for the NHS if you die as soon as possible than if you hang on, clinging onto life needing lots of nursing care and costly medications. And just to kick you when you're down, the side effect of high-dose chemotherapy is that it will effectively ruin or markedly reduce your chances of recovery by crushing your immune system, an essential ingredient to your long-term survival. If, against the odds, you have proven yourself a worthy candidate by surviving the high-dose chemotherapy, the NHS reserve the newer and often eye-poppingly expensive immunotherapies for the people who make it this far. By then, the immunotherapies are, of course, less effective as the immune system is struggling after being blitzed by the chemo. And we wonder why the UK has the worst survival rates in Europe. As a stage 4 patient in the NHS, you're playing a deadly game of snakes and ladders, using conventional therapies alone. If you survive the chemotherapy when the cancer comes back, as it will, chemotherapy alone fails to kill the cancer stem cells. You may then be offered a lifeline, a ladder in the form of a targeted drug to climb back up. If it's available, you grab it, so grateful but tired and exhausted from the previous treatment. If you're lucky, this new drug works for a while, but the effects are only short-term. Average life extension with targeted drugs at this stage is around 2 or 3 months. Boom! You land on another snake and slide back down again. If you're still lucky, They rescue you once more.